us not to recommend more than a year in jail, and old Judge Hartley, a soft touch, gave him only 90 days. I saw him just once while he was in. I had no stomach for it, and my mother by then was nearing the end. When I asked how he was, he looked around, as if he were only now seeing the place for the first time. He was chewing on a toothpick. "I've been in worse," he told me. He had regained all his old harshness, and I found it more upsetting than his fear. Iron-headed, ignorant, he embraced his deepest misfortunes with a kind of pride. The things for which not only he, but I, eventually had come to suffer, he claimed as badges of achievement. He had played in the Olympics of confinement. He could survive a local jail. He had no gratitude to me, no apologies for my shame or for his stupidity. No knowledge of his real prison. It was late in his life. He died not quite 3 years later. But the truth is that for everything that went before, it was not until that moment that I finally gave him up. The afternoon cross begins where I thought the mornings might, in those areas where Horgan is our witness. Stern starts with the calls in March from my phone to Carolyn's. Horgan promptly recollects the recidivist rapist indictment she was trying to draw together that month and acknowledges that one of the chief deputy's primary functions is to assist in the drafting of charges, especially in complex cases. Raymond does not resist Stern's suggestion that Carolyn's trial schedule and my crowded daytime calendar could easily have led to those consultations taking place by phone at night, or at least to calls aimed at scheduling meetings about the proposed indictment. From the calls, Stern moves on to the conversation in Raymond's office the Wednesday after the election. By offering my statement that I was at home the night Carolyn was murdered, the prosecution has, in essence, put in evidence of my defense, and Stern elaborates upon it. Sandy emphasizes that my statement was voluntary. Ms. McDougal encouraged Mr. Savage not to speak. You, Mr. Horgan, asked him not to speak. You, sir, in the strongest terms, you told him to keep his mouth shut? Yet he spoke, and he was clearly quite provoked, was he not? Nothing calculated in his manner. His remarks appeared spontaneous. Stern develops at length a prosecutor's learning about the hazards to an investigation subject of talking. The implication, carefully teased out, is that any person of my background who'd had time to contemplate the prospect of confrontation would have known better than to speak up, especially in this fashion. A man who had been at the scene, Stern is suggesting, who had done what the prosecutors say I did, and who was in charge of the investigation, would know better than to choose a lie so easily exposed. Only a person who truly had not been there, and who was ignorant of the real circumstances, could be provoked by fresh insult to burst out with this truthful response, which chance has bizarrely undermined. Watching Stern do the cross, I foresee his closing argument, and perceive clearly the reasons for keeping me off the stand. Rusty Savage made his spontaneous explanation the day he was first confronted. What else is there really that he can add now, so long after the fact? With my version before the jury, Stern goes about building my credibility. He takes Raymond on an extensive tour of my achievements as a deputy PA. He begins, in fact, with law review, and goes through the succeeding years. When Molto finally objects that this is unnecessary, Sandy explains that Horgan has questioned my judgment in the direction of the Polhemus investigation. It is appropriate that the jury know the full extent of my professional background, so that they are able to recognize that what has been portrayed as unwillingness or insubordination may merely be a disagreement between two veteran prosecuting attorneys. The logic of this position is largely unassailable, and Laren directs Molto to resume his seat. The canonization of St. Rojat goes on.
And so, nearly 2 years ago now, Sandy eventually asks, when Mr. Sennett, then your chief deputy, moved to San Diego, you turned to Mr. Savage to fill that spot?
I did.
And is it fair to say that the chief deputy is the person in the office in whose judgment you place the greatest confidence?
You could say that. I regarded him as the best lawyer for the job.
All right. You had 120 other deputies?
About that.
Including Mr. Della Guardia and Mr. Molto?
Yes.
And you chose Mr. Savage?
I did. Nico looks up, irked, but neither he nor Molto objects.
Sandy works like a jeweler, tapping, tapping at his themes of past resentments. Two of the jurors seem to nod.
And you did not think Mr. Savage would commit a crime? You had absolute and complete confidence in his judgment and integrity, based on working closely with him for more than a decade?
The question is compound and argumentative, but also obvious.
Let it stand, says Laren, when Molto objects.
Raymond weighs the answer.
That's fair, he finally says.
This small concession seems to have had a substantial effect in the jury box. I see now why Stern attacked Raymond at the outset. He had a point to make, not with the jury, but with Raymond Horgan.
Matters are not as clear to Raymond as they were when he walked into the courtroom.
Just so. And it was not necessary for him to check with you on all matters to be sure that he was proceeding in exactly the manner you wished? Stern asks.
I take it that he is trying to minimize the significance of my delay in pursuing the fingerprint report. I always gave the people who worked for me some leeway.
Well, is it not true, Mr. Horgan, that in conducting the investigation of Ms. Polhemus's murder, Mr. Savage knew that you had trusted his judgment on many occasions in the past, including on many substantial matters?
I don't know what he knew, but I had obviously approved of his judgment in the past on a lot of things.
For example, says Sandy, without any indication of what is coming,
you gave Mr. Savage the authority to decide where and when to fire Mr. Della Guardia.
Nico, understandably, erupts. Laren is disturbed. He calls immediately for a conference with the lawyers outside the jury's presence. Some judges hold these meetings, known as sidebars, in the courtroom at the side of the bench away from the jury. Laren's practice, designed to keep the jury from overhearing the lawyers' arguments, is to leave the courtroom entirely and stand in the small anteroom outside his chambers. Della Guardia, Molto, Kemp, Stern, the court reporter, and I all follow the judge out the back door to the courtroom behind his bench. It is clear even before everyone has assembled that the judge is put out with Stern. He regards the last question as a cheap shot.
Now what are we going to do here? He demands of Sandy. Relive ancient history day by day? We are not going to turn this lawsuit into a contest over personalities.
Molto and Nico are both talking. Any past antagonism between the prosecutor and the defendant is irrelevant, they say. Judge Little is clearly inclined to agree.
Your Honor, says Stern, we do not accuse Mr. Della Guardia personally of bad faith, but we believe this is a circumstance indicating how and why he might be misled.
Without saying it, Stern is focusing again on Molto. He has been careful to pick on him and not Nico from the start. Della Guardia is a popular person in this town right now, and known to the jurors. Molto is a cipher. Perhaps Sandy also means to take advantage somehow of the unequivocal promise made at the start that Molto would not testify.
Why Mr. Della Guardia might be misled, Mr. Stern, is irrelevant. What the prosecutor thinks of his case is no matter to this jury. Lord knows you don't want to start getting into that.
Your Honor, says Stern solemnly, it is the theory of the defense that Mr. Savage has been framed in this case.
From this huddled group, I take a step backward myself. I am stunned. Stern had so thoroughly rejected this tactic weeks ago that I had given it no further thought, and things seemed to be going so well without it. Was Horgan's direct that devastating? I no longer understand my own lawyer's theory of defense. Just a moment ago, I thought he was working up one of his delicate, unspoken messages to the jury. Molto wanted Savage's job. He pressed too hard to make a case in order to obtain it, and Della Guardia failed to recognize this because he, even unconsciously, was nursing a grudge of his own. That was vintage Sandy Stern, an artful assessment of human frailty, quietly communicated, designed to diminish the prosecutor's credibility
and to demonstrate how this grotesque error, accusing me, came to be made. That is the kind of believable undercurrent juries eagerly receive. But this is a blunderbuss technique, one which, I had come to agree with Stern, was not worth the risk. Certainly I was not prepared for this change of direction without consultation. And on the record, these corridor conferences are available to the public. The reporters at the break will crowd around the court reporter and beg her to read her notes. I can see the headline. Savage framed, lawyer says. Lord knows what the jurors will think, if any of them fail to miss the unavoidable. Improvising, Sandy has raised the stakes. In the meantime, Nico walks up and down the corridor snorting. I don't believe it, he says two or three times. Laren looks to Molto for a response. Ridiculous, Molto says. Your denial is noted for the record. I mean your response on the point of evidence. If Mr. Stern is truly going to endeavor to prove that the case against Mr. Savage has been manufactured, then I suppose this history of antagonism is relevant for those purposes. That, of course, is one reason why Stern may have gone down the road now, to get normally inadmissible proof before the jury.
I must say, the judge says, Mr. Stern, that you are playing with fire. I don't know where this is going to lead us, but I'll tell you two things. You had better be prepared for the prosecution's response, because the prosecutor will be entitled to quite a bit of latitude in answering. And secondly, proof of this charge better be forthcoming, or I'll strike all the cross-examination on this theme, and I'll do that in the jury's presence.
Laren, from his considerable height, looks down at Stern directly. At this juncture, most defense lawyers, caught running out of bounds, back off and withdraw the question. Stern says simply, I understand. Your Honor, I think we'll see exactly how this will develop. We will offer evidence addressed to the issue.
Very well. We return to the courtroom.
What the hell is he doing?
I ask Kemp as we sit down again at the defense table. Jamie shakes his head. Sandy has not conferred with him either about this. Stern quickly leaves the subject of Nico's firing and moves on to smaller matters. He makes a few more minor points at random and then comes back to the counsel table to confer.
Almost done, he whispers to Kemp and me. I have one further area. Anything more?
I ask him what he was doing out in the hallway, and he places his hand on my shoulder. He says he will discuss it later. Kemp tells Sandy he has nothing else, and Stern once more addresses the witness.
Just a few more questions, Mr. Horgan. You have been most patient. We spoke earlier about a file you assigned to Ms. Pohemus, a very sensitive case. Do you recall that part of the examination?
I believe I'll remember it for quite some time, says Raymond.
He smiles, though.
Did you know, Mr. Horgan, that Mr. Molto was involved in the case described there?
Nico is on his feet first, bellowing in outrage. Laren, for the first time before the jury, shows anger with Stern.
Sir, I have warned you about this area of inquiry.
Your Honor, it is relevant to the defense position I set forth earlier at sidebar.
He means the frame-up theory.
Stern is being elliptical in order to keep the content of the hallway conference from the jury, who were not supposed to hear that conversation. I must tell the court that we have every intention of continuing to investigate this file with the jury, and to offer evidence about it when it is our turn. Indeed, this is the proof I alluded to.
Stern is saying that we are going to put in proof about the B file to support the charge that the case is manufactured. Again, I am astounded by his position. The judge sits back. He rests his hands atop his head and puffs out his cheeks to blow off steam.
For the time being, we have heard enough, he says.
Two questions more, says Sandy with magisterial authority, and turns back to Horgan without waiting for the judge to tell him he may not. Did Mr. Molto ever ask you about that file?
As I recall, yes. After I resigned as PA, he went over everything Rusty, Mr. Savage, had done on the Pohemus case.
And Mr. Molto had that file then?
He did.
And do you know what investigation, if any, he conducted of the allegations contained there?
I do not. I'll answer that, says Nico suddenly.
He is standing. He has quite clearly lost his temper. His color is up and his eyes are wide.
He took no action. He wasn't going to chase Rusty Savage's red herrings.
This speech before the jury would ordinarily be grossly improper, but it is precisely the kind of riposte that Laren's warning in the hallway seemed to invite, and DeLaGuardia has taken full advantage of the opportunity. No doubt he and Tommy discussed this on the way back in from the corridor, and decided that Nico would attempt to make a spirited defense of Molto in the jury's presence. Stern ventures no objection. Instead, he slowly turns to face Molto.
"Mr. DeLaGuardia," he says, "perhaps we will all learn something about red herrings."
He pauses.
"And scapegoats."
Those are the last words from Stern on Raymond's Cross. Laren recesses for the week. On Fridays, he hears motions in other cases. I wait for some explanation from Stern of his new tactics. But he goes on picking up papers from the defense table. Raymond stops by to shake Sandy's hand on his way from the courtroom. He wanders wide of me. Finally, Stern comes to see me. He wipes his face with his handkerchief. He appears relaxed. Leaving aside the last bit, the cross-examination of Horgan went exceptionally well. I am too concerned, however, to congratulate him. "What is this?" I ask. "I thought you told me we weren't going down the road to accusation."
"Clearly, Rusty, I changed my mind."
"Why?" Stern gives me his Latin smile. "The world is full of mystery."
"Instinct," he replies.
"And what evidence are we going to offer?"
"Now you remind me," he says.
He is quite a bit shorter than I am, and he cannot comfortably swing his arm around my shoulder. Instead, he uses another confidential gesture and touches my lapel.
"For the time being, I will have to leave that concern to you," he says, and turns away.
Chapter 30 Tonight I say I am bushed and leave Stern and Kemp early, but there is an appointment I want to keep. I called after court, and, good to his word, Lionel Keneally is here, in a neighborhood tavern called Six Brothers. The cabbie gives me a peculiar look when he drops me. It is not that there are no white people around here. There are a few stoical families holding on against the Ricans and the blacks, but they do not wear chalk-striped suits and carry briefcases. Instead, their shingle-sided bungalows are tucked in among the warehouses and factories which cover most of every block. There is a sausage plant across the street, and the air is heavy with the scent of spices and garlic. The tavern is like so many others out this way, just a joint with formica tables, a vinyl floor, lights over the mirrors. Above the bar, there is a neon hams sign which casts weird shadows from the reflective spangles of the continuous waterfall. Keneally does not even wait for me. Instead, he starts to move when I enter, and I follow him back to a smaller room with four tables where he says we won't be bothered.
"So, what the fuck is this about?"
He is smiling, but his tone is not altogether friendly. "I've got the frigging watch commander out with an indictee, an enemy of the state, an accused homicidal felon. It is no place for a ranking police officer to be seen." "I appreciate you coming, Lionel." He waves that off. He wants me to get down to business. A woman pokes her head in. I decline to drink at first, then think better of it and order a Scotch rocks. Lionel already has a whiskey in his hand. "I need to ask you some questions I should have asked when I came out to see you in the district in April."
"About?"
"About what the hell was going on out in the North Branch 8 or 9 years ago."
"Meaning?"
His look is close. He does not want to get led astray.
"Meaning, was somebody taking money?"
Keneally bolts his drink. He's thinking.
"You know you're hot fucking stuff, don't you?"
he asks.
"I see the papers."
He looks at me.
"You going down on this thing?"
I tell him the truth. "I don't think so. Stern is a magician. He's got three of the jurors thinking about inviting him for dinner. You can tell from the looks on their faces. He cut a good piece out of Horgan today."
They say downtown that Nico doesn't have the horses. They say he went too soon. Molto forced his hand. They say if he had any brains, he would have got you in a room with a tape recorder and somebody you trust, instead of letting Mac make him tell you what he had.
I recognize now that what I thought might be a glaze of alcohol is anger. Lionel Keneally is pissed. He's heard enough about this case to figure that he did something he doesn't do frequently, made an error in judgment.
Myself, I figure you might be going down anyway. Sure as fuck you didn't tell me you were in there handling her glassware when you was out here before.
You want me to tell you I didn't kill her?
Fucking A right I do.
I didn't kill her. Keneally stares, a fierce, immobile look. I know my delivery was too measured to provide him with any assurance.
You are one fucking strange son of a bitch, he says.
The barmaid, wearing one of those old ruffled tops to show the beginning of her cleavage, comes in with my drink. She also puts another tumbler of whiskey in front of Lionel K.
You know, I tell Keneally as I sip, that is something I never understood about myself. I mean, my old lady was as weird as those women downtown carrying around shopping bags, and my old man had spent most of World War II eating dead horses and stuff such as that, which does some work on your cerebrum, believe me. Everything in my whole life was weird, and until this happened, I really thought I was Joe College. That's who I wanted to be, and that's what I thought I was. Really, I thought I was fucking Beaver Cleaver, or whoever the boy next door is these days. I really did. And about the only thing I've gotten out of this experience to date is hearing you tell me I'm one strange son of a bitch, and listening to that little harp string that sounds in my chest when somebody, even if he's half-crocked, has said something that is really right. So I thank you. I tap his glass with mine. I'm not sure that Lionel particularly enjoyed this routine. He watches me for a minute. What'd you come here for, Rusty?
I already told you. Just answer that one question.
Keneally sighs. Ain't you a fucking pip?
One question, all right? And what's said here stays here. It's me and you. I ain't listening to any fucking sob stories about your constitutional rights or that shit. Nobody's fucking calling me to testify against the PA. That happens. The world's gonna think you confessed right here tonight.
I have the ground rules.
Your short answer is, I don't exactly know. Maybe I heard some things, all right? But that wasn't my show. Things out this way were a little loose. You know what I'm saying? Remember, we're talking before Felsky stepped in shit.
Felsky was a bail bondsman who used to take care of certain cops for referring him business. When the bail law was reformed, permitting personal recognizance bonds and obviating the need for outside sureties, Felsky and his coppers maintained their income by selling the coppers' assistance on occasion. Sometimes the cops would talk a witness into not showing up. Sometimes the cops would forget things when they testified. Felsky, however, made such a proposition one day to a man with an electronic lapel pin. The copper involved, named Grubb, flipped for the FBI and took down Felsky and three other officers. That was 5 years ago. Back then, this was a wide-open place.
Was Tommy Molto one of the people you heard things about?
I thought you said one question.
It had subparts.
Keneally doesn't smile. He looks down in his drink.
In this job, you learn you better not say never. Keneally laughs.
Look at you, right?
He laughs again.
He is still angry with himself. All of this is against his better judgment.
But Molto, he says,
never.
He's from the fucking seminary. He'd bring his rosary to court. No chance this guy would take.
Was Carolyn involved with whatever was going on?
He shakes his head.
He is not saying no. He is refusing to answer.
Look, I don't owe you, Rusty, okay? I thought you'd done your job like a professional guy. You came out here before people in the suburbs even knew from gangs, and you worked hard. I give you credit. What else you done, you done. But you come into the projects with me in the middle of the night. You got your fucking hands dirty. But don't push, all right? These guys I owe. You ain't one.
Cop loyalty.
He won't even drop a dime on a dead lady. Keneally drinks his drink and looks out the door. Did Carolyn have anything going with Molto? You know, a personal thing?
Jesus, what's your hang-up with Molto? Guy's strange, like everybody else.
Let's just say he's my best alternative.
What the fuck does that mean?
I wave the question off.
Well, I don't see that guy even catching a whiff of Polhemus. You seen him. Buddy Hackett, right? They were friends, that's all. Buddies.
Sometimes she'd smooth shit out for him. Keneally takes another drink. It wasn't him she was banging.
Who?
No chance, he said. You got enough.
Lionel, I really don't want to beg. He will not look at me. This isn't gossip, for Christ's sake. This is my goddamned life.
The nigger.
What?
She was sleeping with the nigger.
I don't get it at first.
Then I do.
Laren?
You've been out of the North Branch. You remember how it was. It was like everybody used to work in one room.
Three doors, and all of them let you into one office.
P.O., P.A.
Nick Costello was signing in the coppers who come out to testify. He had a desk there. Judge's chambers used to open up there, too. He'd get off the bench noontime, she'd go sashaying in. They weren't making no secret of it.
Fox, says Keneally. I halfway told you last time you was out here. Don't you remember? I told you how she fucked her way to the top. I couldn't figure Horgan hiring her. That's who got her in. Your old buddy there, Judge Motherfucker. He and Horgan got some kind of tie-in.
They were law partners, I say, years ago. Figures, said Lionel. He shakes his head in disgust.
And you won't tell me whether Carolyn was dirty? He raises a finger. I'm gonna leave, he says.
He's quiet for a while.
Sometimes she'd smooth things out, like I say. Molto and the judge, they didn't get along so well. Maybe you heard them stories.
A number.
You know, she was everybody's pal back then. The P.O. Sometimes she'd get the judge to lay off. Sometimes she'd get Molto to take two steps back. She was kind of the referee. Maybe you're right. Maybe Molto was really carrying a big fucking torch for her. Maybe that's why he had sand in his ointment whenever he had to go before the judge. Who knows?
Go figure, people, he says.
I can tell that I've had everything now that I'm going to get. This last little bit was strictly for charity. I pick up my briefcase and leave money for the drinks.
You're a good sod, Keneally.
I'm a fucking fool, is what I am. Half of downtown's going to be talking about this tomorrow. What I tell them we said.
I don't give a shit. Say what you want.
Tell them the truth.
Molto knows what I'm looking for by now.
Maybe that's why I'm in this soup to begin with.
You don't believe that.
I don't know, I tell him. Something's not right.
Chapter 31. We spend the weekend at work, both days. My assignment is to prepare for the end of the state's case, when the defense, as a matter of routine, makes a motion for a directed verdict of acquittal, a request that the judge terminate the trial, declaring that there is not enough evidence for a reasonable jury to convict. This is usually futile. In ruling on the motion, the judge is required to evaluate the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, meaning, for example, that for the purposes of this decision, Judge Little will have to accept Eugenia's testimony right down to her angels. However, a directed verdict ruling is unreviewable. The state may not appeal. As a result, some judges, Laren quite notoriously, use this as a device for imposing the result they favor. Thus, while our prospects are dim, Stern wants to make as strong a presentation as possible. My assignment is to find cases which in some fashion condemn the absence of proof of motive in a circumstantial case. I pass hours in the library. Sunday morning we meet to talk strategy. Sandy still does not want to speak in detail about the defense case. He makes no mention of my testimony or that of other witnesses. Instead, we analyze the remainder of the state's proof. LaPranzer is supposed to testify Monday. The state's case will now begin to gather speed. Their physical evidence will be coming in. The fibers, the phone records, the fingerprints, assuming they can find the glass, the maid who thinks she saw me on the bus, and Kumagai. Stern again emphasizes the point he made to me the other day at lunch. our need to raise doubt in some way about Kumagai. If we cannot, the prosecutors will reach the end of their case having built up tremendous momentum. That, in turn, may force Sandy to change his strategy for our presentation. This is one reason why Stern is unwilling to arrive at any final opinions about what we should do. Together, Kemp and Stern and I puzzle out ways to attack Kumagai. Stern has examined Painless a number of times, and he shares the common opinion that Kumagai is an unpleasant hack. The jury will not be eager to believe him. There are old stories about Painless which I share. Finally, I mentioned that his police department personnel file, where complaints about Kumagai's past performance might be jacketed, would be a good source for us to examine.
Excellent, says Stern. How wonderful to have a prosecutor on our side.
He directs Jamie to draft at once a trial subpoena for the file, and another for records of the pathology lab, so we can see what else Painless was up to in April. We have not issued most of our subpoenas, inasmuch as many of the deputy sheriffs who serve them tend to alert the prosecutors, giving the PAs an opportunity to combat the evidence gathered, or, even worse, to utilize it themselves if it is helpful to the state. But now that the prosecution case is almost complete, we should proceed. Jamie forages through his old notes to be sure we do not miss any of the items we have said we wanted to acquire. He drafts subpoenas for each of Carolyn's doctors, identified from her little phone book, which I found in her apartment.
"And you wanted to subpoena the phone company," Kemp says to me,
"so we can look at their backup data on the MUDs from your house." "Don't bother with that," I say quickly. I do not look up, but I can feel the weight of Kemp's startled glance upon me. Stern, however, goes on without dropping a beat.
"Perhaps if it is not productive to raise questions," says Sandy, "we should consider stipulations."
A stipulation is a statement agreed to by the prosecution and defense, which recites what a witness would say so that he need not be called. As Stern thinks aloud about the possibility, he becomes more convinced it is the right way to proceed. We will agree to the testimony not only of the phone company representatives, but also the hair and fiber experts and the forensic chemist. By doing that, we will shorten the time in which this damaging evidence is actually before the jury. DeLaGuardia may not accept the proposal, but he is likely to. For the prosecutor, there is always a blessing in not having to come forward with your proof. With these decisions made, Kemp and I return to the library, a central conference room in Stern's suite, where the statute books and law reporters are shelved floor to ceiling in dark oak cases on each of the four walls. I work at one table, Kemp at another. I become aware after a few minutes that Jamie is watching me, but I still do not look up.
"I don't get it," he finally says aloud, giving me no choice.
"You said there was something wrong with those phone records." "Jamie, cut me a break. I've thought about it since."
"You said we should look into whether or not they'd been doctored."
The intensity in his eyes is not really anger. There is something vulnerable. As he seldom does, Quentin Kemp, in his cowboy boots and tweed sport coat, looks undefended and young. He thinks of himself as much too hip to be capable of being misled.
"Jamie, it's something I said, okay? Under the circumstances. You understand."
But I can see that he does not understand at all. It bothers me, the look in his eye, his knowing that now he can't believe me. I fold my pad and put on my coat. Sandy is still in his office when I tell him I am leaving for the night. He is studying the reams of scientific evidence that Nico produced in response to our motions. Spectrographs, print charts, the full report of Carolyn's autopsy. He is dressed in casual clothes, a handsome sweater and slacks, and he seems relaxed under the green glass shade of an auditor's lamp, smoking his precious cigar. Lopranza is on the stand on Monday morning. Nico takes care to keep him away from me. The prosecution team walks down the corridor with Lip just as Ernestine is calling court to session. Lopranzer is wearing a suit, something he hates to do, but he still looks more like a convict than a policeman. It is an awful double-knit thing with a kind of carpet-bag pattern. His duck-ass hairdo is particularly slick. I end up holding the door as Lip enters the courtroom, and in spite of the presence of Nico in front of him and Glendenning behind, Lepranzer gives me both a wave and a wink. I am fortified just to see him again. Nico handles Lip well. It is his best examination of the trial so far. He is matter-of-fact, and gets what he has to quickly. He knows that Lip is not friendly. He will tell the truth, but, so different from Horgan, is awaiting any opportunity to bite Nico's heels. DeLay is careful not to give him the chance. If he is professional, he knows he can count on Lip to act the same way. They are both suppressed and brief. Did Mr. Savage ever tell you that he had a personal relationship with Carolyn Polhemus?
Objection. On the same basis as with Mr. Horgan, Mr. Stern? The judge asks.
Indeed.
The objection will be overruled. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you remember what I told you last week about questions based on assumptions. Because Mr. DeLaGuardia is saying it doesn't make it so. You may proceed.
I have wondered how Lip will answer the question, but he says simply, no. Nico did not ask whether I suggested that such a relationship might exist, or whether it was clearly understood by both of us, a question DeLaGuardia, in fact, cannot properly put. He asked if I told him, and Lepranzer has responded correctly. Hedged in by formalities of the rules of evidence, our truth-finding system cuts off the corners on half of what is commonly known. In a clipped, almost British way, Nico elicits the fact that I told Lip not to collect the mud records from my home. And he also brings out from Lepranzer the occasions on which he had to remind me to request computer analysis of the fingerprints found on the glass and elsewhere in Carolyn's apartment. It all emerges between the two of them with a strange undercurrent. I am sure the jury knows something is not right here, and Nico is smart enough at the end to let them know what it is. When he has got what he needs from Lepranzer, he sets up the cross by showing bias. He asks about the cases that Lip and I have worked together. Would it be fair to say that by now the two of you have formed a kind of prosecutorial or investigative team?
Yes, sir.
And as a result of working as a team, have you formed a personal friendship?
Definitely.
A close friendship?
Lip's eyes skate toward me for a moment.
I suppose so.
You trust him?
I do.
And he knows that. Stern objects. Lip can't answer about what I know, and the prosecutor is leading. The witness has already characterized the relationship. Laren sustains the objection on all grounds.
Well, let me put the question like this. Were you assigned to the case initially?
No, sir.
Who was assigned?
Harold Greer, a detective from the 18th District where the crime occurred.
Is he a competent investigator?
In my book?
Nico was careful here, in order both to avoid objections and to keep Lip from zinging him.
Has Mr. Savage ever expressed to you any reservations about Harold Greer's abilities?
No, sir.
Everybody I know thinks of Harold Greer as a top-grade cop.
Thank you, Nico smiles, savoring the bonus. And who, to your knowledge, decided to make this a special command matter and bring you in on this case, Detective Lepranzer?
Mr. Savage requested my assignment, if that's what you're asking. He had Mr. Horgan say so.
To your knowledge, Detective Lepranzer, does the defendant have a closer personal relationship with anyone on the police force?
Lip shrugs.
Not that he's mentioned.
Nico struts a little. So it's fair to say, Detective, is it not, that you are the person on the city police force least likely to suspect Mr. Savage of murder?
The question is objectionable.
Stern starts to move, then ceases, with his hands poised on the arms of his chair. This time, I am keeping pace with him. He has seen Lip hesitate, and knows that Nico, by improvising, has made his first error. He has given Lepranzer an opening, and is going to take a blow.
I would never believe that, Lip
says simply. He leans on never.
Just right.
That will sit well with the jury. He's not going out of his way to hose Nico, but he's taken the opportunity to make his feelings known. Sandy rises to cross. We talked last night about not crossing Lip at all. Stern did not want to emphasize Nico's favorable points. But apparently the direct went even better for the state than Stern anticipated. Nico's direct has opened the door to a kind of catalog of the successes Lip and I have scored together as a way of explaining why I would choose him for the case. Stern runs through them one by one. "And as a matter of fact," says Stern when he is at the end of that, "even in the midst of this murder investigation, you and Mr. Savage were inquiring about yet another matter, weren't you?" Lip is puzzled. "Wasn't there a file which had been stored in Mr. Horgan's drawer?" Sandy does not get any further before Nico is on his feet yelling. Laren picks up his gavel and points it at Stern. "Mr. Stern, I have told you on too many occasions that I do not want to be hearing any more about that file during the prosecutor's case. You went much too far while Mr. Horgan was testifying, and I'm not going to abide any reoccurrence."
"Your Honor, this evidence is critical to our defense. We intend to continue exploring the matter of this file when it is our turn to present evidence."
"Well, if this is critical to your defense, then we can talk about calling Detective LaPranza back at that time. But I advise you, sir, to move on to another area of inquiry, because I have not heard near enough to let you go chasing that hare all over the courtroom at this time. Am I clear?" Judge Little peers over the bench with an impressive concentration of his features. Stern does his little cut-rate bow, inclining his head and shoulders. I find myself disconcerted by Sandy's lapse of judgment. He has taken a beating in the presence of the jury, a setback which was entirely predictable, and I still do not understand what he is trying to accomplish. He's already cast his shadow over Molto with that file. Why does he harp on it? The jury is bound to be disappointed, particularly when he keeps promising to produce evidence that we do not have in hand. We cannot offer the letter I found in the B file because it is hearsay. I do not understand Stern's bluff, and he is cavalier whenever I steer him toward the subject. He treats it as if it is just another courtroom effect. Stern, in the meantime, has come back to the defense table.
"Now, Detective LaPranza, Mr. DeLaGuardia asked you some questions about the telephone records." Sandy holds up the documents. "As I understand your testimony, it was you who raised the matter of his home number with Mr. Savage. Is that right?"
"Yes, sir."
"He did not bring it up?"
"No."
"He did not ask you, in advance, not to obtain the records from his home. Am I right?"
"Absolutely correct."
"In point of fact, he informed you at the start that you might find calls from Ms. Polhemus to one of his phones?"
"In his office, right."
"He didn't ask you or tell you not to seek any records for that reason, did he?"
"No, sir." There is a ringing emphasis to all of Lip's answers. Stern is putting on a demonstration now, showing what a cross-examiner can do with a friendly witness. But it is all too clear. There is no resistance. Lip is more or less allowing Stern to testify. He quickly endorses Stern's proposal that it was LaPranza's own idea not to obtain my home records. He considered them irrelevant. I simply acquiesced in the suggestion, saying, as people often do, that a subpoena was best avoided since it might upset my wife. Sandy returns to counsel table for a document. He numbers it and hands it to Lip for identification. It is the original subpoena deuces tecum to the phone company.
"Now, what prosecutor issued that subpoena?"
"Rusty, Mr. Savage."
"His name appears as the authorizing signatory on the face, does it not?"
"Yes."
"And by its terms, does that subpoena require production of these very records?"
"According to what it says?"
"That's my question."
"The answer is yes. The subpoena would cover these records."
"Does it contain any exemption for Mr. Savage's home?"
"No."
"And any time you or anyone else wanted to examine the records of Mr. Savage's home, this subpoena would require the production of those records?"
"Yes."
"As a matter of fact, please do not answer if this is beyond your knowledge. When Mr. Molto and Mr. DeLaGuardia decided that they wanted those records, they relied on the authority of this subpoena to obtain them, did they not?
I think that's right.
And so, Mr. Savage stands on trial here on the basis of evidence that he himself subpoenaed, correct?
The courtroom ruffles. Nico objects.
The question is argumentative.
Laren shakes his head benignly.
Mr. DeLaGuardia, you're trying to show here that Mr. Savage hindered the gathering of evidence as a way to prove guilty knowledge, and the prosecution is entitled to do that. But the defense is entitled to show that the evidence that is being presented was actually gathered through his efforts. I don't know how else they meet your proof. Overruled.
I repeat, says Stern, standing before Leprenzer. Mr. Savage is being tried here with evidence he himself subpoenaed.
Right, says Lip, eager as a recruit. He adds, just like the fingerprints.
Just so, says Sandy. He proceeds to the fingerprints. It was Savage who personally visited McGrath Hall, met with Lou Balistrieri, demanded that the prints be processed. True, Savage was busy, running the entire PA's office while Horgan campaigned, but again, it was his own efforts that produced the evidence now being used in an attempt to convict him.
Did he obstruct you?
Sandy asks at the end.
Lip sits straight up in his chair.
No.
Did he impede you?
Not in my book.
Indeed, detective. I believe you told Mr. DeLaGuardia that, even if you had known of this evidence, that your respect and affection for Rusty Savage after many years' association is such that you would never have suspected, let alone believed, that he had committed this murder. Is that right?
The way Lip hesitates, I fear for a moment that Stern has gone too far. But then I see that Lip is merely making his own ungainly effort at dramatic effect.
Never, he repeats.
And Stern sits down.
As he does, he smiles furtively at me, a gesture meant largely for the jury. Nonetheless, for the first time, I have the feeling that the jurors are not satisfied by Stern's performance. It is unconvincing. This tour de force still does not explain why I did not volunteer to Lip the information about the calls from my phone, especially the one on the night of the murder. Stern's cross does not offer any reason why I could not work with Harold Greer, whose appearance is surely far more impressive to the jury than Leprenzer's. It does not show what alternatives I had to going to Lou Balistrieri when Leprenzer, not to mention Horgan, was nagging me to do that. And this last exchange, while touching in its awkwardness, is simply baloney. No one could fail to be discomforted by the discovery of the phone records and the prints. The doubtful nature of the cross is emphasized by Lip's obedient response to Stern's guidance. It is all too clear. Leprenzer is a friend, willing to be misled. The jury will not fail to perceive this. It is, as I always feared, the rule of equal and opposite reactions applies in the courtroom as well. Due in large part to his visible reluctance, Dan Leprenzer has been the most damaging witness against me to date. The afternoon continues the downward movement. The stipulations are prepared and read. Coming on the heels of Leprenzer's testimony, the revelation of the actual content of the telephone records is crushing. Nico reads the stip himself. He has finally caught the measure of this jury. They are a bright bunch and want the facts delivered without varnish. Nico assumes a flat, understated tone and looks up just a little when he finishes reading so that he can watch the evidence drive home. The jurors are attentive to him, and I feel the weight of their calculations. I discover that, as a defendant, you experience the lows in the courtroom far more acutely than as an advocate. My afternoon settles into a feeling of weakness, suppression with a coefficient of palpable nausea. The stipulation about the carpet fibers is lengthy, but it has a similar impact. By agreeing to forego the testimony, Nico, in theory, lost the drama of a live presentation.
but the technical witnesses tend to be dry and overly involved. The written summaries are direct enough to have some bite. There is no chance this way that Stern can engage in any of his masterful misdirection or minimization. The facts, as they are, emerge with painful silence. The one favorable aspect, that none of my clothing matched any of the fibers found, is too easily explained. The clothes I wore that night were discarded, with the murder weapon, or simply did not shed. These conclusions, inevitable and arithmetically direct, seem to thicken the air of the courtroom. I can sense them taking place in every quarter. And with them a kind of hush or calm inhabits the place, a dawning resolution. It is more than the mid-afternoon lull. Instead, it seems that all of the observers, including the jurors, have perceived a change in direction, a swing of momentum more in line with original expectations. It has taken the prosecutors longer than it should have, but they are assuming control of the trial, proving their case. As usual, it is Molto, heedless and overeager, who begins to drag me back from the abyss. When the last stipulation is read, he asks for a corridor conference.
"What is it?" asks Laren when we are all assembled.
"Judge," he says, "we are ready to proceed with the fingerprint expert. There's just one small difficulty."
Kemp eyes me with wicked glee.
The difficulty, so-called, is obvious to both of us. They have not found the glass. Jamie's smile is welcome. It is the first sign of any renewed warmth between us in better than a day, and it comes at the right moment. For the members of the defense have each been wordless and grim all afternoon. During the 3:30 recess, I encountered Stern in the John, and we did not say a thing aloud. He gave me one of his Judeo-Latin shrugs. His eyes were listless. "We knew this was coming," he seemed to say. "Our time on the high wire has ended." Now, in the small anteroom to his chambers, Judge Little fulminates. Molto still cannot do anything right in Laren's eyes.
"Are you telling me that you have completed your search, and this object absolutely cannot be found?"
"Judge," he starts to say,
"because that's one set of facts, and I'll have to rule on that basis. But if you're telling me that you think this thing is going to turn up, but it's convenient right now for you to go ahead without it, then that's quite another. We aren't going to be talking about proceeding now and discovering the evidence later. Am I understood?"
Nico catches Tommy's arm. He tells the judge they would like to take one more night.
"That's fine, then," Laren says. "Do I take it that you're moving for an adjournment for the day?"
Nico crisply says,
"Yes."
It is clear that the day's success has fortified him. He can tolerate adversity without distress. His old confidence seems to possess him again.
"Your Honor," says Stern, "I hope the court has not decided to let the prosecution proceed with the fingerprint evidence in the absence of the glass. Certainly, if Your Honor please, we would ask to be heard on that question."
"I quite understand," says Laren. "You may want to do some research on this issue, Mr. Stern, and I'll be happy to hear you. And I can tell you right now, I'm not eager to let anybody get up on the witness stand in my courtroom and give his opinions about what he says was once observed on some physical object that nobody can even find anymore."
He casts a rough-tempered glance toward Molto.
"So you look in the books tonight, and I'll listen to you. And, Mr. DeLaGuardia, if I were you, I'd roll up my shirt sleeves and get over to that evidence room myself."
"Yes, Your Honor," says Nico, dutifully.
Stern gives me a meaningful look from beneath his extended brow as we head into the courtroom. He seems to be inquiring. It is almost as if he thinks that I can account for the glass's absence. Perhaps it is merely a sense of promise that gives Sandy this expression. If Laren were to keep the prosecutors from presenting the fingerprint evidence, the case against me would certainly fail. Stern is not sure whether or not he should be hopeful. Nor am I.
"Would he really think about keeping out that proof?" I ask Stern as we stand behind the counsel table.
We are waiting for the jury to return to the courtroom so that the judge can tell them they are being dismissed for the day.
It strikes me as a serious question of evidence, is it not? We must study tonight.
More time for Kemp and me in the library. I nod, accepting Stern's unspoken instruction. About 9:30 that night, Kemp comes back to Stern's small library to tell me that I have a call. He remains behind to inspect the series of cases I have copied from the reports of the State Supreme and Appellate Courts, while I go to the receptionist's desk, where Jamie has picked up the phone. A line is blinking on hold. I assume it is Barbara. She usually calls about now, hoping to review the day's evidence for a few moments, and every evening I go through an arabesque of diffidence and contained response. The truth is that I have done my best to avoid Barbara since the days immediately before the trial. I have suggested she go to sleep each night before I return. I have eaten dinner with Stern and Kemp, enjoining her even from leaving me a meal. I cannot stand to have her abstracted curiosity turned on this evidence like some high-powered light. I do not want those late-night scenes where we chew over the events of my trial as we did those malefactors I accused. It would make me unbearably ill at ease to hear Barbara engage in close analysis of the tactical decisions undertaken in this trial for my life. Most of all, I do not wish to get drawn into discussions of my discomfort. With the evidence being trotted out each day before us, I know the conclusions she might reach, and in my present state I could not abide that confrontation, to allay suspicions or confirm them. But when I pick up the phone, it is not Barbara's voice I hear.
"How'd I do?" Lip says. "I thought they were going to give you a medal or something with all these terrific things you and I done."
"You were great," I tell him. There's no point in the truth.
"Fucking delay, I'll tell you," he says. "Schmidt come to see me this morning before I got on. He says a little birdie wanted to make sure that I got the message that if I fucked around on the stand, I'd be walking beats in the North End by myself in the middle of the night. Nice subtle stuff with this guy."
I make a sound, general agreement. I have sent a few such messages myself from time to time, to coppers who have a peculiar friendship with defense counsel, who know the defendant from the hood. It's part of the job.
"I thought maybe we could get together tonight," Lip says. "Talk about that thing I said I'd help you with."
He means finding Leon.
"How about I drive you home? You be there a while?"
"Another 2 hours, probably."
"That's good for me. They got me working 4 o'clock to midnight. I'll take my coffee early. Corner Grand and Kendall at 11:30. I'll be driving the unmarked Aries."
We work it like a spy movie. I am in the lobby until the car hoves into sight, and Lip is barely at the curb 5 seconds before he is moving. Now that he is off the witness stand, the pressure on him has lessened, but there are many people who would tell him that the better part of wisdom right now lies in staying away from me. He pulls around the corner so quickly that the rear end gives way a little bit on the pavement, which is slick from a light rain. I compliment him again on his testimony.
"It was good," I say, "because you played it straight." "I'm trying," he says, and reaches for his radio, which is putting out a tremendous ruckus.
"This is great," says Lip of the radio.
"We're working on a dope bust with the G-men to make up for that fiasco in April, and these guys can't get on the air together often enough to make sure nobody gets turfed. They better hope their subject don't have a scanner, because he couldn't miss this posse coming."
I ask about what is going down.
"It's cute," says Lip. "They got a nice-looking little female agent in a mink coat that got seized last time the strike force went in on Muds Corvino's Bolita game. She's making out to be some dope-crazed suburbanite, and she's going to buy 10 keys of coke from somebody in Nearing."
"Probably one of my neighbors," I say. "There's a guy down the block named Cliff Noodleman whose nose is redder than Rudolph's." We are quiet, listening to the radio traffic. Cops and robbers. I feel a vague melancholy when I admit to myself that I miss it. There is lots of static because of the rain. Thunder and lightning must not be far off. I am reluctant to mention Leon first, but I finally ask how Lip is doing.
"I haven't started," he says.
"I will, first thing. Only I haven't got a fucking idea where I ought to look.
That's what I wanted to hear. You got some suggestions?
I don't know, Lip. It shouldn't be that hard to find a faggot named Leon. Go interview waiters or interior decorators. Probably moved to San Francisco, you know, or died of AIDS or some crap.
I refuse to respond to Lip's suggestion that his efforts will be futile. We are quiet a moment. The radio barks.
Can I ask a question? He says after a while. Is this really so important?
To me?
Yeah.
Damn right.
Can I ask why?
I mean, you really think this Jamoke's gonna give you something?
I tell him what I told him before. I want to find something, Lip. That's the most honest way I can put it.
On Molto?
On Molto, right. That's the way I've got it figured, as much as I can figure it all.
We are down near the bus terminal, a bleak place at any hour, but especially at midnight with rain. I look out toward it, a sad hulk in the dark. Lip's dwindling faith in me hangs in here with a misty sadness of its own. More even than the risks, that is what bothers him. From his own perspective, he's figured it out. I want to use this thing with Molto as a diversion, as Nico put it, a red herring. Lip's reluctance is obvious to both of us, and it is a dismal sign of where I am that I must lever him with our friendship to make him do what I know he would resist for almost anyone else.
Let's run a sheet, at least. Berman, Sandy's PI, says he couldn't even get a rap sheet out of the department.
I told you, man. They closed down tight on this thing. They're going to be in Keneally's shit in a big way for giving you the time of day.
I take a moment. How did you hear about that?
Watch Commander don't get anywhere that people don't notice.
The rain beads on the window. The air is close. I understand the spy stuff on the street corner now.
What's he tell you?
Lip asks.
Not much. He told me that Carolyn and Laren used to be an item a long time ago.
What do you think of that?
I think she got around, says LaPranzer. Same thing I always thought.
He said that Laren clouded her into the PA's office through Raymond.
That fits, says Lip.
That's what I thought.
He tell you anything else?
More ancient history, you know. The North Branch used to be a dirty old place, but he thinks Molto was clean.
And you believe him? About Molto?
I don't want to.
I wouldn't take that guy's advice on clean or dirty, I'll tell you that. God only knows where he's coming from.
What is it with you and Lionel?
Not my kind of cop, says LaPranzer simply.
We've crossed the nearing bridge by now and have entered the sudden dark of the suburban neighborhoods, out of the garishness of the highway's yellow sulfur lights.
I worked out his way when I started, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he says. I seen him in action. Not my kind of cop.
I decide I won't ask. Lip looks out the windshield. The shadows of the wipers move across his face.
We're talking 12, 14 years ago now, he says at last. Things were different, I'm the first to admit that, okay? Everybody's on a pad back then, all right? Everybody.
Lip looks straight at me, and I know what he means. I find it unsettling. The pimps, the barkeeps, they just put up the dough. You didn't even ask about it. It was there. So, I'm not casting stones, okay?
But one night, I'm coming out of a place, 2, 3 in the morning, squad comes running down the street full speed and stops dead. First I think it's me he wants, so I come a little closer. But he don't even see me. It's Keneally. You know, he's a sergeant by then, so he's riding alone, beat supervisor. And he's looking across the street, right in the doorway. There's a hooker, okay? Black gal. You know, she's got the skirt on up to her chin and leopard top or some such shit. Anyway, I hear his whistle, you know? Like for a dog or horse. Big loud number like that. And he pulls the black and white into the alley. Gets out, looks down the street towards this pro, and he's pointing like this.
Lip shoots an index finger down toward his groin.
Big smile. And this lady, she waits and she waits. And he keeps pointing and smiling. He says something I don't quite hear.
Don't say no, something like that. Anyway, she goes slow down the street like, oh, man, don't tell me, dragging her purse like she's got maybe an anvil in sight. And Keneally's got his big smile. Sits down right there in the squad. All I see is his legs sticking out the door, his shorts down around his ankles, and this lady on her knees while she's working. Fucker didn't even take off his hat. Lip swings into my driveway. He takes the car out of gear and lights a cigarette. He ain't my kind of cop, he says again.
Chapter 32. The trial's first pitched battle over an issue of law occurs the next day and occupies the entire morning. Nico describes a 6-hour item-by-item search of the police evidence room. They cannot find the glass. Both sides have prepared written memoranda addressed to whether testimony about the fingerprints on the glass may nonetheless be received. Kemp wrote our brief sometime after midnight. Molto must have started later than that, since Nico said they were in the Warrens of the evidence room past 1 o'clock. Each man wears the hazy, red-eyed look of a lawyer on trial. Laren retires to his chambers to read both briefs, then returns to hear oral argument. At the start, it is supposed to be only Nico and Stern addressing the court, but each turns so often to his second that before long all four lawyers are talking, with the judge interrupting, posing hypothetical questions, and, on occasion, thinking out loud. Stern makes his points with greater vehemence than at any time during the trial. Perhaps he senses an opportunity for triumph. Perhaps desperation is gathering after yesterday's sobering events. He keeps emphasizing the fundamental unfairness of forcing the defendant to confront scientific testimony whose basis we have had.